News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next. And we welcome you to the Wednesday morning show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. And in part one of today's morning show, I am very excited to be able to talk about yet another secret garden walk here in Kenosha presented by the Four Seasons Garden Club. And Linda Guy, with longtime connections to WGTD, is here as she always is to be kind of our tour guide for the gardens that are going to be part of this year's walk. Seven different private gardens in the Kenosha area, and the garden walk is occurring this Saturday, July 13th, and it looks right now like it's going to be a mostly sunny day according to the weather forecast right in front of me. So so Linda Guy is happy about that, as are everyone who wants to take in the garden. And we have a kind of a special added topic to talk about today. The bonus garden on this year's Secret Garden Walk is actually a garden that's not secret at all. We're talking actually about Chiwaukee Prairie, which, of course, is a beautiful native garden. And Pam Holey is with us. She is president of the Chiwaukee Prairie Preservation Fund. And we'll be finding out a little bit about how the Chiwaukee Prairie figures into this year's private secret garden walk. So Linda Guy and Pam Holey, we welcome both of you to the morning show.
Thank you, Greg.
Thank you. Pleasure to be here.
Good to have both of you here. Linda, we've talked before. I don't think we need to go into this in a lot of thorough detail, but maybe you can just briefly summarize kind of the process by which the secret garden walk each year takes shape. I mean, Who sits around the table and what kind of conversations ensue in terms of putting that particular year's secret garden walk together?
Oh, you don't want to hear all the dirty details behind the scene, I'm sure. Now, it doesn't just fall fully formed from the sky. This is the work of a very busy committee. We have co-chairs this year. Then that's actually they've co-chaired for the last 3 years. The same two gals, and that's worked out very well for us because there's a lot of responsibilities that can be bounced back and forth. As soon as this year's garden walk is over, we're working on next year's garden walk. The biggest challenge immediately is finding the gardens. And we look to the guests who come through on this year's tour to make suggestions for perhaps their garden, perhaps friends or family gardens. And we're very very happy to go out and take a look at what you're offering, and hopefully it's something that that we'll enjoy showing off, and you'll enjoy participating in. And so we look at gardens anywhere from the end of July through, I hate to say, sometimes it goes through October. And hopefully by the end of fall, we've got our lineup for next year. And there will be, occasionally there may be changes, things happen, life gets in the way, and we'll hope that all of those gardens will be still available come spring, and for the most part they are. We look for a variety. You and I have talked about that before, how this is kind of a something for everyone sort of tour. We look for old gardens, new gardens, big gardens, small gardens, specialty gardens. This year we're pleased we have a rose garden on the tour. Everybody loves a rose garden. We've also got a garden where the homeowner, a gentleman, has done some interesting things with hardscape and some inventive watering systems and such.
Wow!
So you know, all these things that that make a garden special and make it interesting.
Something distinctive out of the ordinary.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So this year, it sounds like you noticed that many of the gardens that were going to be on this tour, because you like them to be, to at least to some extent, kind of consolidated.
Logistically convenient?
Yeah, right. So you're not wandering to all corners of the county.
Well,
you noticed this year that all of your gardens were relatively close to beautiful Chiwaukee Prairie. And so that prompted then a decision to approach Chiwaukee Prairie.
Exactly. Yeah, there's things like this that just develop during the process. We found ourselves with three or four gardens that are very close to the prairie, or absolutely, you know, back up to the prairie, and that reminded us that there are very involved, dedicated volunteers in Pam's organization, who they've presented and spoken to the club a couple of different times, and we on our side of it we make donations toward the land purchase, and we've been doing that for as long as I've been a member of the club.
55 years.
Wow.
there's been a good relationship back and forth between the two organizations. And the fact that we were right in their backyard this year with three of the homes in particular, it was a natural to say, okay, let's give a little mini peek into Chiwaukee Prairie for people who have heard of it, never visited it. This is an introduction. And for those who've enjoyed the prairie for years and know it and love it, they can, you know, visit for a little bit themselves. We're not offering anybody a lengthy tour, but just to get a little interest generated.
Very good. I think it's a wonderful idea. Speaking of interest, Pam Holy, when did you first become so interested in Chiwaukee Prairie and so, in a sense, invested in its preservation?
Well, I grew up on the south side of Kenosha, so I was aware of the dunes and the prairie young. When I came back to this area, I started doing the tours and volunteering out there. And very quickly got, shanghaied into the presidency about 12 years ago. And since then, we've really moved on with our acquisition. We are now acquiring lots out there on our own. Previously, it was the Nature Conservancy and more recently the DNR. But there was a hiatus in purchasing and people interested in selling, because the whole of the prairie actually was platted into small lots at one time, either in the 1920s or in the 1940s. So we're still working at buying those back. It was over 500 parcels. We're down to around 40 south of 116th and about the same number north of 116th.
Wow. So for somebody who has not ever seen Chiwaukee Prairie, first of all, explain exactly where it is located.
Okay. It is the Chiwaukee Prairie State Natural Area at this point, which extends from the Kenosha Dunes to the state line along the lake. It runs through parts of Carroll Beach, and then south of 116th is what was originally called Shiawake Prairie because it was named in the 1920s as Shiawake on the Lake, a combination of Chicago Kenosha, and it was supposed to be a very exclusive development with an 18-hole golf course and mansions along the lake, all of which wound up in the lake that were built except for one, which is still there, and it's pretty much on a peninsula at this point because the lake has eroded in as it's continuing to do. So that was the original Shiawake. The Nature Conservancy helped the volunteers 55 years ago start acquiring property out there, and it's just gone on since.
Hmm. So explain to our listeners what something has to be in order to be characterized properly as a prairie.
A prairie. Okay. It would be the plant material. There would be, by definition, almost no trees. This particular prairie is a combination of wet mesic prairie. It is a wetland of international importance, actually, or part of it, that extends from Kenosha all the way to Waukegan. And it is a lake plain prairie, which means it was created by the recession of Lake Michigan. And actually, we're the oldest garden on the tour because the plant material is about 4,000 years old.
Wow, okay. Fair enough. So when one walks the prairie, and it's been a long, long time, I'm sad to say, since I've had the chance to do that, what are the kinds of things that one sees? What sorts of plants?
Well, over 400 species of native plants are there. It is the richest prairie in Wisconsin. And you're going to see different things bloom. In most gardens in the city or gardens that are on the walk, the plants will bloom very for a long time. So you get the color and in groups for a long time. In the prairie, things are all mixed up. They sorted themselves out based on the soil, the water conditions, and other factors. And so you're going to see different things from week to week. You see different things in the prairie. A month ago, you saw huge patches of lupin blooming. They were gorgeous. These days, if you go drive through the prairie, you're going to see a lot of the spiderwort, and it just dots blue all over the prairie. And if you walk through the prairie, you will be dotted blue because the petals melt every day. The one that bloomed is now melting, and it gets on anyhow. So it continuously changes from week to week, and in any one area, if you were to stand in any one area, mark out a 10-foot square, there would be just any number of species, some of which would be blooming now, some of which will bloom later. So it's a real mixed-up thing, not at all like plots of flowers here and there.
Right. And, of course, what you're describing, it has its own wonderful beauty, and there's plenty of people who are, that's their favorite kind of beauty.
Yes, right. It's remarkable. Mm-hmm. It is an ecological jewel, and anyone who takes the time to walk through it and enjoy it will quickly realize that.
Right. Speaking of time, I know that one of the most important things that happens with the many volunteers with Shiawake Prairie is the idea of attacking invasive species. What kind of an issue is that at Shiawake Prairie?
It's a continuing issue, and we wind up with new ones as time goes on. They come in from the railroad, they come in from mowers along the roadside, and it's continuous. We have been fortunate enough to be part of the Lake Plain partners from Lake County Forest Preserve District, Illinois IDNR, RDNR. We have gotten several federal grants, and some of those have been used to help control buckthorn, which is a brush species, a shrub that comes in and takes over areas in the prairie, and also the forbs that come in the growing season. So it could be reed canary grass, it could be hairy willow herb or loosestrife or garlic mustard, or, you know, there are lots of them. And right now we have a group of Youth Conservation Corps young people who are helping us combat common St. John's wort, which is in the summer a very serious invasive species.
Hmm. So that is a ongoing work.
Ongoing.
Yes.
And every month we do, every third Saturday we have a volunteer day. Anybody interested, just check our website, shiwaukee.org.
Right. And the work goes on, and that's part of what allows Shiwaukee Prairie to be as beautiful as it is. So logistically, how does this plug into the tour, Linda? I mean, what do people, in what way do they get to visit Shiwaukee Prairie on this tour?
Well, they are very conveniently located, the booth, the display area that they're setting up as part of the tour, is right between two of the homes on the tour. So, as you're traveling on Lakeshore Drive to get to from one home to the next, it's a very convenient stop along the way. As with the tour in general, it's self-guided. You've got, you know, whatever time you choose to spend at a home, every home, a select number of homes, and the prairie, it's all on your own timetable. But convenience-wise, we got that covered.
Absolutely. That's absolutely fantastic. So Shiwaukee Prairie as a special bonus garden on this year's Secret Garden Walk. Let's talk quickly about the other gardens that are on the tour. And as I'm reading through the booklet, my eyes lit up to read about the garden of Chris and Randy Rich and the fact that their garden will include vegetables.
Absolutely.
And that we don't always have vegetable gardens on the tour.
No, you're right. This garden has a little bit of everything. But they do have extensive vegetable gardens in raised beds. And it's something that they've been maintaining for years and developing along the way. And she makes comment in the write up in the book here that they not only feed their family, but they feed their friends and their friends' families. And as with vegetables, and it's not just zucchini, there's always plenty to share.
So there's a real bounty there.
But it's not exclusively a vegetable garden. I don't know what kind of space exactly, but there's probably at least an acre that we're talking about here.
Very good. It looks like the next garden is one of those that is immediately adjacent to Shiwaukee Prairie, and so that's one of the gardens that makes this partnership make sense.
It's a lovely garden, kind of in the cottage garden style, but here it is, sandwiched between the lake to the east and the prairie to the west. So out of that space, this gardener has managed to battle back the lake that we know wants to intrude, and the prairie, which Mother Nature seems to want to, you know, periodically reclaim. So in the midst of that is a lovely cottage garden. So there is this duality of dealing with what nature hands you and the adjustments that you choose to make to it.
Absolutely.
But it's a lovely garden that, again, offers a little bit of everything. There's no vegetables at that location.
The next garden talks about how things change as they expand and how they've actually even had to work at growing vertically, not just horizontally. And I love that that sense of what they call whimsy and imagination that has gone into this particular garden.
This is very much a family-oriented space. They love the plantings. They love the color. They love all the planted areas that they have. But they also have children and family events, and a lot of their activities center around kids and the pool and that sort of thing. And like you said, they've gone vertical. This is the one I mentioned, or the gentleman there has done some major construction, creating Okay, taking a guess now, I would say there were at least 8, possibly 10-foot columns with planters on top of the columns.
Wow.
Which makes a lovely display, but you still got to water those planters. He has also devised a watering system that waters those planters automatically.
That's
without,
cool.
You know, getting on a ladder and carrying up a watering can. So there's some things that he has done with the hardscape and the layout of the garden to accommodate family and activities, and then he's taken it one step further and kind of created his own we can call it a science experiment. We can call
sort of, yeah. You know? I think that's great. That yeah. just adds one more layer of interest to everything.
Exactly.
As I read about the garden of Ruth and Tom Clark, what jumped out at me is that there are actually art pieces that are incorporated into this garden. That sounds really intriguing.
Yeah. Mr. Clark is very, very inventive and enjoys his space. This is a garden that is not quite as secret as some of our other gardens. This is right on a corner off of Third Avenue, and the garden can be seen from the street, but you don't want to just peek over the fence.
Mm.
You want to go in and explore.
Right.
It's not just the art pieces, but he's kind of created an environment that creates kind of a hybrid between the what you might expect to find in a city garden and what you might expect to find on the prairie, with the intent of making it a haven for migrating butterflies. So if you're a butterfly, make sure you stop and check out this garden. It's got everything that the butterflies could possibly want, and that's kind of his latest project.
I love that. I think that's absolutely great. One of the gardens in your booklet is titled January Dreams, and the writer talks about moving into their house in January of 2011, when, of course, there wouldn't be much of a garden in evidence, and one might even not have a sense of the possibilities at that point.
Well, gardeners are dreamers, and this is a garden that has fulfilled some of those initial dreams, what she was hoping for when she moved in January. Mr. Clark's garden and this one are probably about the same size, but a smaller garden on our tour. But this is a lady who has created just a wonderland in what is a basic city lot. And it shows what can be accomplished with a small space. And one of those accomplishments is over 100 varieties of roses.
Wow.
Which I would like to make sure our audience is aware, she has meticulously labeled.
Ah.
So all of these different ones.
So when you walk through, you'll know what you're seeing. I think that's terrific.
They are identified. And it's not just the roses, too. She has also spent time with lilies and has worked to do some hybridizing and development of different species. When I first met her, I was impressed. This is not just a gardener. This is a scientist. So
that's neat. Liz Dutton's garden, which is next, has the headline Beautiful Imperfection, which she says in her essay is her style of gardening. And it sounds like this is quite a large garden and a source of great delight for her.
This is a massive garden. This was a huge garden when she was on the tour about 5 years ago. Liz has since then doubled her space. What was an acre is now 2 acres. They purchased the lot next door, and in 5 years' time, it it looks like, you know, she's been working this garden for 20 years. Mm. She's just a powerhouse of energy. She runs, does all of this and runs a daycare out of her home.
Wow.
So this is that duality of creating space that serves multiple purposes.
Wow.
In this garden, there is a vegetable area. There are numerous play areas. But, you know, the plantings all tie everything together. And Liz is a member of the club, and boy, are we glad to have her.
I can imagine.
She speaks well for all of us.
That's great. Gardening at its best. And what do you want to say about the final garden titled with this interesting title, Great Bones and Hidden Treasures?
Yeah. The story behind this one is one of those typical, okay, now that we've got it, what do we do with it stories? And the ladies who own this home have spent years reclaiming what had been there that had been neglected after a number of years. We've all been in that situation. Some of us, I'm embarrassed to say, have kind of created that situation, They have, over the years, uncovered treasures in their garden, both in terms of plant material and hardscape, and have turned into gardeners. They didn't necessarily arrive as gardeners, but the garden has kind of created their reputations, I suppose.
I like that. Well, that's a great concept. And man, this is a wonderful array of gardens. I'm very, very impressed with what has been put together. It looks like it's going to be an exceptionally lovely tour. So we want to remind people that it's this Saturday. That's the 13th of July. It happens rain or shine. Now it looks like it's going to be plenty of shine for you.
Nothing but shine.
Exactly. And if people buy the tickets in advance, they're $8. Otherwise, you can buy your tickets at each of the gardens on Saturday, but then that will be $10.
Correct.
And where are the places that people can buy tickets for this year's Secret Garden Walk?
It's hard to avoid a place that you can buy. We have 9 ticket outlets extending beyond Kenosha this year. I'll run through them quickly. Jack Andreas has been representing us for many years. Also Sunnyside Florist and Gifts on 75th Street. The Steins location on Green Bay Road in Kenosha, the A Summer's Garden Florist downtown Kenosha. We've added Suburban Garden Center on the north side of town, and on the opposite end of town, close to all of our friends down in Carroll Beach, Anton's Greenhouse and Garden Centers. So all of these are immediately in the Kenosha area. We also have Milliger's in Sturtevant, Westosha Floral in Paddock Lake, and down in Gurnee, Illinois, Balmas Flowers.
Wow.
So we're out there. No excuses, folks.
That's right.
Don't tell me you can't find a ticket.
Yeah, they are everywhere. Fantastic. And this, of course, is a major fundraiser, the major fundraiser for the Four Seasons Garden Club for all of the scholarships they dispense and all the other good things that they do. Pam Holy, if people want to learn more about Shewaukee Prairie or perhaps become a volunteer or be of help in some way or another, what would be the best way for them to contact you?
Oh, stop by on Saturday.
Ah, okay.
Or it's 204 102nd Street is where our tent and everyone will be there to answer questions and introduce people to the prairie, or shiwaukee.org.
Excellent, Shiwaukee. Yeah. And I am very embarrassed to admit that today I learned for the first time where that name comes from.
Oh.
That had never dawned on me.
Oh.
Chicago and Milwaukee.
I'm with you on that one.
Yeah.
In reading some of the literature that Pam had shared with us, I learned it too. So.
Wow, well, I like that. So
yeah.
It's... kind of what we're all about here in the corridor. So very good. Pam Holy and Linda Guy, great to have both of you here to talk about this year's Secret Garden Walk from the Four Seasons Garden Club, coming up again this Saturday, July 13th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. Thank you for being part of the morning show today.
Well, thank you, Greg.
You're very welcome, Greg.
The time is 8:40, and here is part two of today's program here on WGTD, your gateway to public radio. And to finish out today's morning show here on WGTD, we're going to be talking Shakespeare, and bloody Shakespeare, I might add. We are going to be talking about one of his most dramatic plays, Titus Andronicus, and we will be talking about it with three people who are going to be helping to present this powerful play to the public this coming weekend. We're talking about the Fleeing Artists, kicking off their second season and their Summer Shakespeare series with performances of Titus Andronicus, and a little later in the summer, performances of Taming of the Shrew and The Tempest. We have with us Alex Metalski, who is one of the co-founders of Fleeing Artists Theater, their communications director, and portraying the role of Marcus in this production. Kenny Motley, also co-founder of Fleeing Artists Theater, president right now of the organization, and portraying the role of Aaron. And finally, Denise Johnson, or Dee, portraying Lavinia in this production. She is the HR person at Fleeing Artists and their secretary. And all three of these people have been, of course, very, very busy in the final rehearsals for Titus Andronicus, which, as I said, opens this coming weekend. And we welcome all three of you back to the morning show.
Ooh, thank you for having us.
So, Alex, you and I have communicated the most directly about Fleeing Artists over the time. And sure. Just remind our listeners, but very briefly, because we have a lot to talk about,
right.
Kind of the sort of the central purpose of why Fleeing Artists was created.
Sure. The reason we exist is to create theater in Kenosha for Kenosha, and to spread as much artistry as we can throughout our community.
And Kenny, has this all unfolded the way you envisioned as one of the co-founders?
Yeah, I think I really enjoyed how everything turned out. It was a lot of turmoil and stuff at the beginning, but we all buckled down, strapped our boots on, and, got through it. And I think we're putting out some great, great art right now in Kenosha.
It's probably one of those things where, in the abstract, it means one thing to create a theater company. It's another thing to actually make it happen and to take care of all the details and put stuff on the stage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Sure. It's creating art, which in and of itself is a challenge, and it's building a company, a business, which in of itself is a different sort of challenge.
Right. So I'm trying to remember, did you do Shakespeare last summer?
Sure. Summer Shakespeare, this year's our sixth year. Last year we did Medea, which was not Shakespeare, it was Greek, it was our first Greek, and we did Twelfth Night, a comedy.
Right. There we go. So this year, Titus Andronicus, tell us about the choice to do this particular play, given the fact that it is so incredibly violent, probably the most violent of any of Shakespeare's many plays.
Yes, I believe it's the play that has the highest body count, or certainly one of the highest body counts. A big reason we chose to do this is many of our board members and many of our staff are highly passionate about the show, but also its subject matter about revenge, about the lack of female voice in a male society really speaks to today's climate, politically, socially, et cetera.
Wow. Did you have any hesitancy about doing this? I mean, even though it is timely and powerful and so on, but the fact remains, as you just said, it's really a blood-drenched story.
Right.
And, I should think that facet of it probably gave you at least a little bit of pause.
We wanted to make sure that we could do the show and the subject matter justice. But we also kept in mind that not everyone in Kenosha likes blood and guts. So we also chose to do Taming of the Shrew, something much more lighthearted, at least in most people's minds.
Right. give our listeners at least the basic framework of this plot and some sense of why there is so much violence in it, nearly from start to finish.
Well, it's a revenge tragedy. So essentially, all of the characters, protagonists, antagonists, heroes, and villains, all engage in revenge. Titus, a military general, returns home to Rome after 10 years of war with the Goths. He brings with him some prisoners, including the Queen of the Goths. And in a very bloody ceremony right at the out of the gate, kills the eldest son of the Queen of the Goths just to appease the gods. This enrages Tamora, understandably, and she plots with her surviving son's revenge on the Andronikai family. Mm. And for the most part succeeds, which causes the Andronikai then to engage in revenge, and it's a never-ending cycle, as revenge often is.
Let's hear from Dee Johnson, who is portraying a really important character in all of this and someone who, in a sense, bears some of the most serious brunt of this lust for revenge. Tell us who you are in the story.
I play Lavinia, which is she's the daughter of Titus Andronicus. And there's a lot of stuff that happens to her. I don't know if I'm allowed to say what happened.
Just a Cliff Notes version.
Spoiler alert. So she gets her hands and her tongue cut out after being ravished. And so she later on kind of gets her version of, well, justice in her opinion with what happens to the people who do it to her.
Wow. Yeah, so it's some of the most awful things that occur in this play occur to your character of Lavinia. And we'll talk in a moment about just the challenge of portraying such events or such horror on the stage. Kenny, who are you portraying?
I'm Aaron. I'm pretty much the person who plots all of this. So I'm like the villain of the show. I'm the one who plots to, you know, get Lavinia, you know, ravished and her hands cut out and her tongue cut out, and I'm the one who, you know, plots against the Andronikai family and against Rome and against the Goths as well, really. Like, he plots against everyone in the play and really doesn't explain exactly why he does it, but you can kind of get the feeling with his words why he does what he does.
And who is he exactly? I mean, who is he related to? Or
He gets captured with the Goths that Titus brings in. He's kind of a eyepiece for Tamora, kind of her lover, you know, on the side thing.
So she has especially this burning desire for revenge, and he is the one who helps plot it and carry it out.
He's a very, very smart, very manipulative, you know, very selfish person.
Interesting. And Alex, who are you?
I play Marcus, who is the brother of Titus, the younger brother, non-military. He's basically the equivalent of a Speaker of the House or the majority leader in the Senate.
Okay.
Very powerful, but not emperor.
Right. So this would maybe be a question best put to Brianna Duffy, who is directing this production, but I'll ask the three of you, whoever wants to respond. Does all of this violence and mayhem occur offstage, and then is it talked about, or is any of it actually on stage? And to what extent does it pose a challenge to convey or portray events such as this?
Well, one of the tenets of theater is spectacle, and especially with a show like this, is trying to portray as much of it on stage as possible. Given the level of blood and violence, not every single death is going to occur on stage, but we do try to show as much as possible rather than tell.
Wow. So, for instance, Dee, in terms of the terrible things that happened to Lavinia, how do you convey that she has been tortured, that these terrible things have happened to her?
So those things we don't show on stage.
I mean, we don't show them, but we see her after these have occurred to
right,
her, right?
Right, yeah. So she comes back into the scene, and you can see, you know, she's got her hands cut off, and she at some point will open her mouth, and it's just full of blood, and so she can't speak, and she can't tell anybody what happened to her. And it's all more in my facial features, I guess, of trying to convey what I'm trying to say to people. And it's interesting because in one of the following scenes, then you kind of get multiple characters trying to say what she's trying to say to them, and nobody's getting what she's trying to say except for Marcus, ironically, which is her uncle. And so it's been a lot of just facial features, a lot of emotion. It's a hard place to kind of get back from after I've been there. So it's good to have actors that I trust to do the scenes with and to kind of follow up with everything. And it's tough, but it's definitely challenging, and it's fun in that sense that it is challenging for me.
Right. A fun challenge, even if what's being talked
heavy.
About is not
yes.
yeah, very heavy.
A heavy
and
challenge.
Not very fun. How experienced is the cast in terms of doing Shakespeare? Is this something that all of you have done a fair amount of, or by and large are a lot of you newcomers to Shakespeare?
Sure. Yeah, I think it's a lot of different experience levels. There's people who've, you know, only have been doing this for a year, so, you know, they don't know Shakespeare as much. And there's people like I've been doing Shakespeare for probably like 15 years now.
Wow.
So, like, I've been doing Shakespeare for a long time. So, mm-hmm. So, like, and I think it's really good to have that different experience levels because, the people who've been doing it for a while can teach people who've been doing it for a year. And even though I've been doing it for so long, I still learn things from people who've just picked this up. Mm. Like, I get something, I'm like, wow, I'd never even thought to think about it like that. But, yes. Mm. So I think it's really great to have all that different experience levels and having a different group of people because we don't want it to just be like a bunch of people who know Shakespeare very well. It's great to have people who's just like, you know, I really want to just try this out, you know, and getting them involved and growing their passion for Shakespeare.
Fantastic. Who would you suggest come to this in terms of ages and so on? I mean, It's a story that's full of terrible things, but since we don't see much of that actually happen on the stage, it's more that we see the aftermath. So do people need to be concerned about who they bring to this, for instance, or do you feel like just about anyone mature enough to understand Shakespeare will be able to take this in?
I think as long as you are mindful of what the subject matter is about and what your own tastes are, what your own standards are, I think this is certainly a show worth seeing. It's not often done, and it's certainly not often done in communities like Kenosha, one of the reasons we chose to do it. The subject matter is powerful and will speak to everybody today, even though the show is over 400 years old.
Wow. Yes.
Yeah. I wouldn't bring any children or anything like that.
No kids.
No children, anything like that. If you're okay with your teenager and stuff watching things like, you know, Pulp Fiction or things like that where it's just
Game of Thrones.
Yeah, Game of Thrones. Yes, exactly. That's a perfect thing. Like something like that. If you're okay with your children watching something like that, of course bring them down for this because this is way less, you know, than Game of Thrones and things like that, and they'll learn something from it, you know. They'll learn how to spot evil.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of evil in this show, that's for sure. Dee, how large a cast are we talking about?
20 people.
20 people,
I think. Yeah, and then we have a good crew of five.
About five people, so about 25 involved in this
people,
one.
Give or take.
Wow. Pretty big. So it's a big show in a lot of different ways. So so this is Titus Andronicus. It's going to be done at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha. It opens on the 12th and runs through the 21st. So we're talking about evenings at 7:30 and a couple of matinees. Those would be the
Sundays.
The Sundays will be at 2 o'clock. So Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoons. At the Rhodey Opera House, this Shakespeare play called Titus Andronicus, blood-drenched and incredibly dramatic. And it's a rare opportunity to see this particular Shakespeare show. And then I know that you are also excited about a couple of things that come right thereafter. First of all, Alex, you've already mentioned a much lighter show, really fun show, Taming of the Shrew,
yes,
which is going to be done. And do I remember that's in the open air, an open air production?
It's our outdoor. One of the tenets of Summer Shakespeare is performing free shows for the public. And this year we're performing our lighthearted comedy, Taming of the Shrew. It's the original Battle of the Sexes, essentially.
And are all of you on stage for that as well?
It hasn't had auditions yet.
Oh,
so,
okay.
But yeah, so auditions are coming soon. And
next
then,
week.
Yeah, yep. Next week we have auditions, and then we'll see who's in that cast.
Gotcha. Very good. Very good. Yeah. So, and then after that, Alex, tell our listeners about the performances of Shakespeare's The Tempest and the unlikely setting for those performances coming up in August.
Sure. This show, originally we were planning on doing two shows, Titus and Taming, but by a happenstance, Captain Andrew of Tall Ships reached out to us and asked if we were interested in putting on a show. And despite how busy we all are and how crazy it is, we decided to put on Shakespeare's The Tempest on the Red Witch on one of the tall ships, one of the boats in Kenosha Harbor. And that will be performing all of August and the first week of September, Tuesdays in Racine, Thursdays in Kenosha.
Wow.
Yeah.
So it's maybe a little premature to even know the answer to this, but where on that tall ship will this performance take place, and
all
logistically, how's that going to work?
All of it. So for those who don't know, just imagine a classic wooden ship about 60 feet long. We'll be performing on the starboard, on port, on stern. I don't know nautical terms yet. I still got to learn that. But we'll be performing throughout the entire ship. The audience will be at hand, also on top. And it will just be five actors playing all the parts, navigating the dangerous waters, as it were, of Lake Michigan.
Wow.
Yeah.
Very, very intriguing. So Shakespeare's Tempest coming up in August,
yep.
As is also Taming of the Shrew, but more at hand opening this Friday night will be Titus Andronicus, Shakespeare's most violent play. Performances this coming weekend and the following weekend at the Rhodey Opera House in downtown Kenosha. I imagine that when you walk out of a rehearsal, you must feel drained in a way that isn't always the case when one does Shakespeare. What kind of ordeal or gauntlet has this been for you as members of the cast?
I think the heat is really...
We sweat a lot.
Yeah, we sweat a lot. I think it's... to go into these really dark places and just mentally is draining, but I think that's why we all have each other, and we're all like, we all hang out with each other afterwards, we all talk, we all joke, we try to make everything a light situation. But, you know, when things are serious and we're doing things up there that are very serious, of course we take it very serious. But afterwards, we make sure, you know, hug each other, love each other, make sure, you know, I really don't think that about you. I know I've done some horrible things in this play to you, but I want you to know that I love you, and like stuff like that, that reassurance and, you know, that compassion for each other, I think really helps this not be so bad.
Right.
But it's a bloody situation
to say the least. Well, it's a rare opportunity for people to experience this powerful play by Shakespeare again, Titus Andronicus, at the Rodi Opera House this weekend and the following weekend. I know you have a Facebook page
People
can get a lot of that information. Otherwise, a website or
www.fleeingartists.org.
Very good. Alex Matowski, Kenny Motley, Denise Johnson, all part of this cast for Titus Andronicus. Thank you for being part of the morning show today. Best wishes to you and all of your castmates.
Thank you so much.
I wanted to be sure to mention that the website for the Four Seasons Garden Club with the Secret Garden Walk that we talked about in part one of today's program is the numeral 4 Seasons Garden Club, 4SeasonsGardenClub.org, the numeral 4. You can find